The Tom Woods Show, episode 2057.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I just finished recording an episode of the Robert Scott Bell Show. I've known Robert for quite a long time, and he and I have been good friends. And I, in the course of doing so, was told by his producer about an interesting article that appeared in The Week, and it was about the resurgence of libertarianism. And I thought, I have to read this one first because I've seen too many articles like this. And then I turned to it and they're celebrating all the worst parts of libertarianism, all the worst corners of it. So let me wait and see. And it actually turns out to be a pretty decent article. So I'm going to get to that in a minute. But before I do that, I want to let those of you in the New York City area know that there is a Soho Forum debate coming up. And you can attend it, in effect, without having to comply with the vaccine requirement by doing the following. First of all, let me give you the details. The subject of the resolution being debated is as follows. The federal government should increase its efforts to reduce the harms caused by social media. That's what's being debated February 17th, 2022. So on the one hand, you have Jonathan Haidt, who's a professor at New York University. And then on the other side, you have Robbie Suave, who's a senior editor at Reason Magazine. And he's the author of Tech Panic, Why We Shouldn't Fear Facebook and the Future. So you can either attend the event in person, or to avoid all the craziness, you can go to Gene Epstein's house or his apartment. You can actually sit in Gene's own apartment. He has a 123-inch TV screen you can watch the debate from, and there'll be a reception afterwards. So you can be there for the live streaming simulcast party and reception afterward with a bunch of like-minded people. Your friend Robbie the Fire Bernstein, who co-hosts Part of the Problem with Dave Smith, will be doing comedy. So it's going to be a wonderful event to attend. So if you'd like to do that, then go to thesohoforum.org. That's thesohoforum.org and get your tickets. I'm not being paid to do this. This is not a paid advertisement. It's that I love Gene Epstein. He's a very good friend of the Tom Woods Show and a great guy, hardworking, does a lot of good stuff for our movement. And I just want the word to get out about this. And Gene, as I say, is doing the best he can. He's opening his own home to you so that you can enjoy an event like this without having to go along with the craziness. So thesohoforum.org is where to go to check that out. Now, on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2057, I will include a link to the article I want to talk to you about today. And that is a piece by Samuel Goldman called The Rise and Fall and Rise Again of the Libertarian Movement. And I just wanted to comment on it because, as I say, here it is in The Week, which is a pretty mainstream outlet, and it's not terrible. And it doesn't make us look ridiculous. So this is a surprise. This is a cause for celebration. It starts off by saying that right around the time of the, let's say, the ending of the Obama administration, there was what some people started to refer to as the libertarian moment. Because at that time, Rand Paul was actually rather popular, even though his presidential campaign didn't really go anywhere. He made the front page of a major magazine, and doggone it, I can't remember off the top of my head, calling him something like the most interesting man in America. Hard to believe that not that many years ago, something like that could still happen. And there was interest in maybe reworking American foreign policy to be not so interventionist and to be concerned about civil liberties and the drug war and issues like this. Not to mention economic views that libertarians have, enjoying some, let's say, renaissance. And then Donald Trump came along. And according to this article, Donald Trump represented the end of the libertarian moment. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that it made much difference because I'm not sure the libertarian moment was really as big a thing as people thought. I think there was a much bigger libertarian moment back during the times of the Ron Paul presidential campaign. So way more than in, say, 2015 when he was just a retired congressman at that time. So anyway, I'm not sure I'd go for this, Trump destroyed it, but there is an interesting point to be made here, which is that the Trump movement, at least part of it, did view the idea of Trump as being seizing control of the state apparatus and using it toward your own ends. Now, that's obviously not libertarian, but I don't think that was the entirety of the Trump movement. Trump himself is impossible to pin down. He's like Ross Perot. If you want to really find a consistent philosophical grounding there, you're going to be looking pretty hard. He had some instincts. Some of them were good, some of them not so good. But I don't think his movement was entirely, I mean, there certainly you do see voices talking about a new industrial policy or, let's say, state involvement with the social media platforms, stuff like that. But when it came to energy policy, I would say Trump was about as libertarian as you could ask for, realistically. So I don't know that it's quite right to say that. And Trump's foreign policy wasn't much to write home about, but he didn't start any major wars. And I know that that's we got slim pickings here. I realize that's not saying a whole lot, but that's something. Honestly, when you look back at president after president after president leading up to him, that's actually something worth noting. So even though he was not all he was cracked up to be and didn't accomplish what, you know, he might have accomplished, I wouldn't say that exactly he was some enemy of libertarianism that put an end to this libertarian moment any more than any other president would have been. If there had been Jeb Bush nominated, who was, I think, assumed by a lot of people to be the natural nominee, would anybody have written articles saying, well, Jeb Bush represents the end to the libertarian moment? I don't think they would have, because some of these reporters think of somebody like a Jeb Bush as being a free marketeer, that Trump wasn't because of his views on trade, but Jeb Bush was, despite his 50 million deviations from market economics. And so I think a lot of these people base their opinions of the Jeb Bushes of the world on what they say in speeches. And yeah, the thing is, I'm sure Jeb Bush has some speechwriters who would write pretty little speeches about the free market. And so it would seem like, okay, well, he may not be a libertarian, but he's still sort of in line with the libertarian moment. So I just don't buy that Trump represented some unique break, because any Republican likely to get the nomination was going to be pretty disastrous. George W. Bush was a disaster for the free market, even though I'm sure he also gave very pretty speeches about it. Nevertheless, it's true that you can find people in the Trump orbit who were more concerned about the alleged common good and who were unconvinced by libertarian arguments. And they, you know, maybe thought these libertarian arguments were short-sighted or selfish or whatever, and that we needed a more robust approach to governance that took into account something more than just the welfare of isolated individuals. Okay, yeah, I'm sure there was some of that. But what the article says happened next, here I can agree with the analysis fully, which is that as the pandemic has continued, now I'm quoting, opposition to restrictions on personal conduct, suspicion of expert authority, and free speech for controversial opinions have become dominant themes in center-right argument and activism. That's definitely true. And as a matter of fact, just the other day, I realize this is about as anecdotal as it gets, but I was on Twitter and somebody had started a thread saying, is it just me or have other people during this period asked themselves, am I maybe a libertarian? So I think all this might have actually done us some good. As a country, it's been terrible, but it has opened a lot of eyes. Again, though, the one problem with this article is I get that we're all supposed to say Trump is completely worthless and this and that. And by the way, as I've said with Lou Rockwell, I don't think Trump should run for re-election. There are many, many reasons against that. But because of this felt need to denounce Trump, we get poorer analysis, because opposition to restrictions on personal conduct, well, after he did put Fauci in charge of this, he backed away from that. And Trump was clearly saying, after he made terrible mistakes at the beginning, that the country should open back up. So that became a Trumpian theme. Suspicion of expert authority? Yeah, that's also a Trumpian theme. And free speech for controversial opinions? That's a Trumpian theme. So this dichotomy that, well, before we were in these terrible Trump years, and then suddenly these three libertarian ideas have since come to the fore, Trump advocated all of those. So again, the analysis isn't quite right, but leaving Trump out of the picture, the analysis kind of works, that it is true that the libertarian perspective is indeed not growing by leaps and bounds, but is growing. And at the very beginning of all this, you remember March 2020, oh, did people have a field day saying, I wouldn't want to be a libertarian during a pandemic, ha, 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 because everybody knows we need authoritarian measures to protect our health. Well, after 2 years of one disaster after another with these alleged, what we laughingly call the mitigation measures, I can pretty safely say, you know what, I'm very happy to be a libertarian during a pandemic. Yeah, that's not embarrassing to me at all. I would be embarrassed if I had supported all these measures. Well, then Goldman says that, of course, during this period that we've just been enduring, we've seen, for example, a growth in interest in the so-called school choice movement because of all the disruptions to public education and all the COVID mandates and stuff like that. That's definitely encouraged not only that movement, but homeschooling, which is not mentioned in the article. So it's true that that kind of thing, that kind of libertarian theme has garnered more attention because of what's been happening. But he then says this, it would be a mistake to think these appeals succeed because Americans have any newfound appreciation for Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, or other libertarian thinkers. Why do they always mention Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek of all people? I mean, they're great people who made great contributions, but they would not be the first people I would think of. Hayek's main contributions, if you ask me, are his economics. His political analysis is sort of okay, but it makes way, way too many concessions. And even Milton Friedman makes too many concessions. I'm just going to say it. But anyway, Goldman says that more than the spread of ideological libertarianism, what's really happening here is that this revival in libertarian ideas is not coming from the idea that everybody in America is reading libertarian books all of a sudden and they're interested in libertarianism. It's that what's coming out is a natural anti-authoritarianism baked into certain aspects of American culture. That's what's happening here. It's not that everybody woke up one day and in the middle of the COVID crisis and started reading the Mises Institute website over and over and that's what's doing it. It's that it's an appeal to something very deep-seated in American culture, to anti-authoritarianism in response to Fauci and the CDC and the rest of it. That's probably true, I think. That's probably true. But at the same time, I do think some people have been driven into our arms, let's say, more explicitly even than that. They're not just falling back on an inchoate anti-authoritarianism. I think there are more people listening to libertarian voices. There are more people listening to me. And they came from somewhere. And it could be that they start off listening to somebody like me without knowing everything there is to know about libertarianism, but they're curious, and eventually they get there. Then we have this paragraph. Whatever its origins, the new quasi-libertarianism is an obstacle to the managerial tendencies that increasingly define the center-left. Great sentence. Great. The next sentence, I'm not quite sure I follow. More than opposition to the government as such, it revolves around opposition to administrative restrictions imposed for one's own good. Well, okay, so maybe they're saying that rather than being opposed to government per se, it's opposed to government doing these particular things. And that may certainly be. And again, that reminds me of, I'm so sorry I told this story so many times, but that reminds me of this person on Twitter who's been great on COVID, was, I think, a lifelong Democrat, has had her eyes really, really opened, has been really terrific. And then one day said, you know, our health officials need to give us more nutritional guidance. Wait, what? Why would you think that after watching them for 2 years screw this whole thing up? Why would you want to look to these people for nutritional guidance? But that is what was going on, is that this was a person who didn't like administrative restrictions imposed for one's own good. But that doesn't mean she's against government per se. She thinks government should do the following six things, just not these eight. I think there is some of that. That is true. But what I think is happening there is that these are people who are just getting their feet wet with our ideas. We check in with her in another year, she's going to be embarrassed that she said that, as so many of us are years later. We look back on naive things we had said in the past. And then we read this. If the old libertarianism was obsessed with the risk of ideological totalitarianism, the new version concentrates on the influence of human resources bureaucrats, public health officials, and neighborhood busybodies. I don't see that there's any contradiction between these two things. I think I, therefore, am both an old and a new libertarian, and I favor all of those positions. I favor being opposed to totalitarianism and to public health officials, neighborhood busybodies, etc. They say its idealized enemy, this alleged new libertarianism, isn't the commissar, it's the high school guidance counselor. I say, why not both? But what he's talking about is a reorientation, and these are his words, from philosophical to mundane grievances. So instead of theorizing, let's say, with Hayek about the road to serfdom, which is nothing wrong with theorizing about that, but that today there's more of a focus on the immediate, the here and now, not necessarily where things are going to be in 5 years, but right now there's somebody making my kid's life miserable, and I'm focused on that. And he continues by saying that it used to be that the left benefited from its association with resistance to busybodies. Whereas today, he says, outspoken progressives are prominent among those demanding censorship of putative misinformation, including Rogan's removal from the Spotify platform that hosts his podcast. And so now suddenly that's shifted. Nobody likes busybodies. So now this whatever libertarian movement they're describing that's getting stronger is benefiting from the fact that basically people also don't like busybodies. And then he points out, Goldman points out, that there is among this so-called new right, there is this sense that we've got to grab hold of the institutions of the state and just put them to the service of our own interests. And they would say that libertarians are utopian. But as Goldman says, it's these people's hope that the dour and devout can achieve theoretically rational outcomes by capturing and redirecting some of the same institutions that have been discredited during the pandemic that now seems utopian. And then further, he says that this inchoate libertarian revival can also be accounted for in part by what he says are the unimpressive performance of schools, the FDA, and other vehicles of public policy, which have undermined the ambitious goals Democrats hope to pursue under the Biden administration. It's hard to make the case for free college, increased educational spending, or single-payer health care when the institutions that would have to deliver these benefits seem unwilling or unable to do their current jobs. Progressives don't want to hear it, but the era of big government is probably over again. So even though the analysis may be off here and there, nevertheless, I still like this article because it does make some legitimate points about our current political situation. It treats us with respect that our ideas are not crazy and that the other side has some real weak points. It's so rare to come across this that I just thought I would make some note of it because I think it does, going back to something I said earlier, make a very valid point that just 2 years ago, the word libertarian, which had been briefly almost fashionable for a moment, became a term of abuse because who wants to be a libertarian during a pandemic? Well, after 2 years of Dr. Fauci, I think anyone in his right mind wants to be a libertarian during a pandemic. Now, let me take a few minutes to talk about something else that I want to alert you to. Now, if you're listening to this right now, chances are you're not listening to it on YouTube because I'm on another ban on YouTube. They did not like my episode 2051 on mask wearing. They did not like that. They still are sticking to the standard view on that, even though the standard authorities seem to have changed their minds a bit on it. So that means two strikes in under a 90-day period, two strikes in just a few days. So it's pretty likely if they want to get rid of me, they'll find an excuse. So there's a decent chance that after having had a YouTube channel all these years and I made all those videos defending Ron Paul and all that stuff, all that blast from the past could be gone in a matter of days. So unfortunately, I can't reach the people who watch the show or listen to the show on YouTube because I'm on this ban. And by the time the ban is lifted, in I think it's a week, something like that, and we have a big influx of episodes, I don't know that they're going to listen to all of them, so they might miss this. I don't know how to find these people, but I may not have this channel, this YouTube channel, for much longer. Now, thank goodness, it's a small fraction of my listenership that listens to me on YouTube, so it's not like my audience numbers are really going to suffer that much, but people do stumble upon you at random on YouTube with recommended videos and stuff like that. And so I will lose that form of organic traffic, unfortunately. So I am on Odyssey, as you all know. So I made a shortcut link to that. TomWoods.com/vid, V-I-D, will take you right over to my Odyssey link. Odyssey is O-D-Y-S-E-E, by the way, but TomWoods.com/vid will take you there and you'll find everything I've created is over there. because it's really easy with Odyssey to back it all up. You just click something and, you know, within, depending on how much stuff you have, not very much time has to pass before all of it is backed up on Odyssey. So if the unthinkable were to happen, at least I would have the consolation of not losing everything I've created for over 12, I don't know, 13, 14 years. I'm not exactly sure how long I've had my YouTube channel. But all of that would still survive thanks to the people at Odyssey. I am on the verge of starting up an account at Rumble. I focused on Odyssey because I know the people who created it and I trust them. But I'll do Rumble also because why not? Might as well try to reach as many people as possible. So it's annoying. It's annoying. And maybe I need your help in some way to get the word out about where I'm going to be. I'm probably going to send out a note to my email newsletter today about this. As I say, I'll survive. I don't need the traffic from YouTube, strictly speaking. But it's irritating because I'm not saying anything that's false. And I kind of feel like deep down they know that. I mean, really, at this stage, they're really going to keep defending these various positions. Come on. Especially with countless people now in the official establishment saying, well, you know, on second thought, maybe so-and-so. I'm telling you, if I could go back and look at various things they've criticized about me over the past couple of years and then compare them to what at least some portions of the establishment are saying now, either you got to criticize them too or you got to lift the criticism of me. And somehow I doubt either one of those will happen. So that's what happened. This morning I woke up and there was an email from YouTube saying you have another strike. And that's their rule. If I violate their so-called community guidelines three times in 90 days, then that does it. Or it's if they identify one. Okay, well, I'm sure I have a lot of things they wouldn't like, you know? So it's, as I say, it's okay. This is an object lesson, I think, for a lot of us, that you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. And I have very deliberately not done that. I have not monetized my videos on YouTube. I don't in any way rely on YouTube to make my living. So for those of you who either do or who might have done so, let that be a lesson that you want to spread around what you're doing and don't rely on just one source for your viewers, for your support, for your income. Build something that belongs to you. And, you know, I've heard that advice being given a lot. My friend Ben Settle, who's just such a great guy, has been urging people to take that advice for a long time. Now, Ben is an interesting case study, by the way. Ben is the, he's been a guest on my show several times. He is the publisher of the Email Players newsletter, which I read every month and I get inspiration and ideas from. And he has not been on social media, period, for probably several years now. He had a really thriving Facebook group, and he didn't wait for them to take it away. He left voluntarily. He got off Twitter and all that, and that violates everything you would think would be sensible advice. Why wouldn't you want to be present on these platforms? And yet, he's doing better than ever. He is thriving better than ever. And even I doubted his move. Why would you do that? Even I doubted it. But you can't argue with results. He's actually doing better than ever. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to pull the plug on all my social media accounts. I personally don't think that's the correct strategy for me. But if those plugs were pulled on me, I would still survive. Because again, I'm not relying on that for my well-being. Now, it's true that a good portion of what I do depends on my mailing list. And you say, well, a service could shut you off. That's true, but I own the list. I back that list up every day. I have a copy of it on my devices. So they can't take that from me. Even if they deprive me of their services, that's okay. Ben has Berserker Mail. I could always use that if I want to. So I own that. And that's how I'm able to keep on going. It's because of that. And because I've tried to divide my spheres of influence up so that, you know, I'm like a multi-headed monster. That's the way you should be thinking. Do not depend on these people for your livelihood or for your sphere of influence, because they'll come after you eventually. Count on it. Count on it. If you're talking about stuff like this, count on it. But even if you're not, even if you're talking about something completely uncontroversial, make sure you have a strategy that gets your face onto different platforms, because you just never know. It could be anything. They could come up with anything to come after you. So it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. I've enjoyed being on YouTube. And I suppose it's not an absolute ironclad guarantee that I'll be off, but the odds aren't looking too good. So if you do like and appreciate what I've been trying to do on the Tom Woods Show, another way you can help things out is to support me through supportinglisteners.com, support the continuation of the show. And that's at supportinglisteners.com. And you get a lot of nice benefits there. And one of them is you actually get transcripts of all the interviews I do. Another one is you get entry into the Tom Woods Show Elite, which I took off Facebook years ago because I could see the writing on the wall. And everybody had been telling me, you got to move off Facebook. And I thought, look, I'd love to move off Facebook, but no one's going to follow me. This isn't going to work. Okay, I'm happy to admit when I'm wrong. I was wrong. I have a thriving group that's not on Facebook, that's censorship-free. I was wrong. I've never been happier to have been wrong. Okay, it has worked out great. So I would love to have you over there, and we're all going to get through this. This is the thing we're all in together. We're in this together. I'll tell you what the this is. The this is being put upon by institutions like YouTube that want to do this to people. And if you're going to try to give me the, but YouTube is a private company thing, I just can't understand how dopey somebody could be as to think that that's an argument. Let's say I concede that, yes, YouTube is a private company. Why can't I criticize it? I can criticize a private company. I can say, this restaurant serves terrible food and post that online. Nobody says, hey, I thought you were a libertarian. How dare you criticize the free market? I'm really not actually criticizing the free market. I'm criticizing this one actor. And I know people with an IQ above 80 are capable of making that distinction. And I know I have an above 80 IQ community out there. So I don't worry about you guys. I just worry about the occasional. I don't worry about. I'm just dealing with the occasional hater here. So that's the situation, everybody. Old Woods is on the ropes when it comes to YouTube, but he's got some tricks up his sleeve, and he's got, I think, loyal people who are going to stick with him through thick and thin and make sure and keep on spreading the word about the show to like-minded friends so that we can overcome the loss of what looks like will eventually be my YouTube channel. So that's all I have to say, everybody. Supportinglisteners.com is the website, and I'll see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.